Hi, I'm Amy Goodman. If you're tuning in right now, Democracy Now! Is probably your source for news you can trust. Democracy Now! Is independent, which means we're funded by you, not the oil, gas, and coal companies when we cover climate change or the weapons manufacturers when we cover war and peace. If you and everyone who tunes into this podcast made just one $10 donation right now, we could cover our operating costs for 2019. Really, that's all it would take. Please make your tax-deductible donation today by visiting our website at democracynow.org. Have a wonderful holiday season and Happy New Year. Thank you so much. In Katowice, Poland, this is Democracy Now!
We are not prepared to die. And the Maldives has no intention of dying. We are not going to become the first victims of the climate crisis.
The former president of the Maldives, Mohamed Nasheed, issues a dire warning, saying the survival of low-lying island nations are at risk. It comes a day after the UN Secretary General warned failure at these climate talks would be suicidal. We'll speak to President Nasheed, and then dozens of Polish high school students join an international school strike today to protest the world's inaction on climate change.
They know the facts, and maybe they sometimes don't want to admit it, but they know everything what they need to know. They know the solutions. They know that we need to change, because otherwise the world will change in a way we don't want to know.
Then what is Extinction Rebellion? All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In an historic vote, the U.S. Senate has passed a resolution calling for an end to U.S. military and financial support for the Saudi-led war on Yemen. This represents the first time in U.S. history the Senate's voted to withdraw military forces from an unauthorized war using the War Powers Resolution. The measure passed 56-41. Democratic Senator Chris Murphy of Connecticut co-sponsored the bill.
I think today is a watershed moment for Congress. We are reasserting our responsibility to be a co-equal branch with the executive in foreign policy making. It's a role that Congress has abdicated for decades. And what we showed in this vote today is that Republicans and Democrats are ready to get back in the business of working with a president, and sometimes against a president, to set the foreign policy of this nation.
But the bill is not expected to pass the House this year. On Thursday, House Republicans narrowly passed a farm bill, which included a provision blocking a War Powers Resolution vote on Yemen. The U.S.-backed Saudi war has devastated Yemen. A new report says half of Yemen's 28 million people are now food insecure. Nearly 3,000 people died in Yemen just last month, making it the deadliest month in the past 2 years of war. On Thursday, warring parties in Yemen agreed to a ceasefire in the strategic port city of Hodeidah. In another vote related to Saudi Arabia, senators again rebuked President Trump.
This is now unanimously, the United States Senate has said that Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman is responsible for the murder of Jamal Khashoggi.
That was Republican Senator Bob Corker, chair of the Foreign Relations Committee. President Trump and a number of top White House officials have refused to acknowledge Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman's involvement in the murder of the Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi, despite the CIA concluding with high confidence he was directly responsible for ordering the journalist's killing. Both Democratic and Republican senators have said for weeks they believe bin Salman is guilty. Khashoggi was a U.S. resident and columnist for The Washington Post. He was killed by Saudi agents after entering the Saudi consulate in Istanbul on October 2nd, and then his body dismembered. The Washington Post is running a full-page ad today calling for meaningful action to be taken over Khashoggi's murder. The ad reads, quote, "A life is gone. The principles of free expression endure." A 7-year-old Guatemalan girl has died of dehydration and shock while in the custody of U.S. Border Patrol. She was detained last Thursday along with her father and other migrants who crossed into the United States in a remote section of New Mexico. She was brought to the hospital only after her body temperature was over 105 degrees. Cynthia Pompa of the ACLU said, quote, "The fact that it took a week for this to come to light shows the need for transparency for Customs and Border Protection. We call for a rigorous investigation into how this tragedy happened and serious reforms to prevent future deaths." President Trump's 2016 inauguration committee is reportedly under investigation by federal prosecutors. The probe is related to possible misuse of funds and whether any foreign donors received access to the Trump administration in exchange for contributions. Russian gun rights activist Mary Butina has pleaded guilty to conspiring to act as a Russian agent without registering with the Justice Department. Butina has been jailed since July after being accused of trying to infiltrate the NRA and other right-wing groups in the lead-up to the 2016 election. The House of Representatives have overwhelmingly passed a resolution calling for the release of jailed Burmese Reuters journalists Wa Lone and Cha So-woo. The vote came as journalists and press freedom advocates marked the first anniversary of the journalists' imprisonment after they were arrested while investigating a massacre committed by the Burmese military targeting Rohingya Muslims in the village of Indin. They were sentenced to 7 years in prison. In Rangoon, more than 100 Burmese journalists rallied this week calling for their release.
The government's job is not to protect the military. The government is ignoring the fact that it needs democracy to develop the country the right way. Instead, the government is protecting a human rights violation committed by the army.
On Monday, the journalists were honored as part of Time magazine's Person of the Year feature, which was dedicated to persecuted journalists around the world. In Iraq, Najib Mirad delivered a speech to high-level Iraqi officials just days after she received this year's Nobel Peace Prize.
I come to Baghdad carrying the Nobel Peace Prize to say to all Iraqis that we are all victims of terrorism and Daesh, Islamic State, and their blasphemous minds. So I call upon you to act as one confronting your enemy. I come to Baghdad to appeal to the new government to be a national government for all Iraqis, regardless of their religion, ethnicity, and language.
Nadia Murad is a 25-year-old Yazidi Kurdish human rights activist from Iraq. She was kidnapped by the Islamic State, repeatedly raped as she was held as a sex slave for almost 3 years. In Argentina, a court convicted two former Ford Motor executives of aiding in the kidnapping and torture of 24 workers during Argentina's military dictatorship in the 1970s. Pedro Müller and Hector Francisco Sabia were sentenced to 10 and 12 years in prison, respectively. They were found guilty of providing the personal information of workers to military forces, as well as allowing interrogations inside the Ford factory. The case is the first time executives of a multinational corporation were found guilty of human rights crimes in Argentina. Lawyers for the victims have said they may also sue Ford in U.S. courts. In France, police have shot and killed 29-year-old Sherif Shakhat, the suspected gunman of Tuesday's attack in the northeast city of Strasbourg, which killed three and injured a dozen others. French authorities are referring to Shakhat as a terrorist and say he was being monitored and had been radicalized. Shakhat was reportedly scheduled to be arrested for an armed robbery and attempted murder charge on the day of the shooting. In news from Africa, President Trump's national security adviser, John Bolton, has called on Morocco to finally hold a referendum in the occupied Western Sahara. Morocco has occupied Western Sahara since 1975. No other country in the world recognizes its sovereignty over the territory. In 1991, the UN promised Sahrawis a referendum on self-determination. Since then, Morocco's blocked attempts to organize the vote. Bolton spoke Thursday at the Heritage Foundation.
all we want to do is hold a referendum for 70,000 voters. It's 27 years later. The status of the territory is still unresolved. I've gotten to know the Sawari people. I have enormous respect for them. I have enormous respect for the government and people of Morocco and Algeria. Is there not a way to resolve this?
National Security Advisor John Bolton's comments came a week after Morocco and the Western Saharan Liberation Movement, known as the Polisario Front, held their first direct talks in 6 years. The two sides agreed to continue negotiations in the coming months. UN envoy Horst Köhler said, quote, a peaceful solution to this conflict is possible, unquote. Over the past four decades, thousands of Western Sahara's indigenous people, the Sahrawi, have been tortured, imprisoned, killed, and disappeared while resisting the Moroccan occupation. You can see Democracy Now!'s exclusive documentary, 4 Days in Western Sahara, Africa's Last Colony, at democracynow.org. Education Secretary Betsy DeVos will cancel $150 million in student debt after being forced to abandon efforts to block a rule that created protections for students whose for-profit college defrauded them or shut down. In October, a judge sided with attorneys general from 18 states in the District of Columbia who sued DeVos for delaying the Obama-era rule. The policy allows for students to automatically have their debt canceled without formally applying for the benefit. And in North Carolina, the state legislature has approved a bill requiring a new primary and election if the state's election board calls for a revote in the contested 9th congressional district race. The race pits Republican Mark Harris against Democrat Dan McCready. Harris initially appeared to be the winner, but the race was never certified after evidence emerged of possible election fraud by Republicans who are accused of tampering with absentee ballots. Politico is reporting Republicans may try to run another candidate in place of the scandal-ridden Harris. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We are broadcasting from the UN Climate Summit in Katowice, Poland. This marks the 10th UN Climate Summit Democracy Now! Has reported from, beginning in Copenhagen. As we broadcast, hundreds of climate justice activists are staging a protest just behind us, right inside these UN talks. The convention center, by the way, that's modeled after a coal mine. We turn now to our first segment. We are not prepared to die. Those are the words of Mohamed Nasheed, the former president of the low-lying island country of the Maldives, delivered here at the UN Climate Summit. On Thursday, Nasheed delivered an impassioned plea for nations to overcome their differences and take decisive action to tackle climate change.
We are not prepared to die. And the Maldives has no intention of dying. We are not going to become the first victims of the climate crisis. Instead, we are going to do everything in our power to keep our heads above the water. We are not winning the battle. Half of the problem is that we are still begging the big polluters to stop polluting on ethical grounds. But they are not listening to us. They never were. So instead, rather than asking for cuts, perhaps we should be demanding an increase in investments in clean energy.
That's former Maldives President Mohamed Nasheed, recently returned home to his island nation after 2 years in exile. He came to power as the first democratically elected leader of the Maldives in 2008 and became recognized internationally for his leadership on climate change. Nasheed once held a cabinet meeting underwater to highlight the threat of global warming to the Maldives. He also pledged to make the Maldives the first carbon-neutral country and installed solar panels on the roof of his presidential residence. Nasheed's presidency ended in 2012 in what many believe was a coup d'etat orchestrated by the opposition and supported by the military. In 2015, he was sentenced to 13 years in prison after being charged under Maldives' anti-terrorism law in 2015, a charge that Amnesty International described as politically motivated. A year later, he was allowed to leave for Britain for medical treatment. In November, he returned to the Maldives after living in exile for 2 years. This came 2 months after his party returned to power. On November 26, Maldives' top court vacated Nasheed's sentence, saying he was wrongfully charged. Internationally, Mohamed Nasheed is recognized as a climate champion. In 2012, director John Chank released the film titled The Island President on Mohamed Nasheed's rise to power and his climate activism. This is an excerpt.
If we can't stop the seas rising, if you allow for a 2-degree rise in temperature, you are actually agreeing to kill us.
Well, fast forward to 2018, and Mohamed Nasheed is continuing his quest for climate justice. Just a month after returning from exile, Nasheed is now leading the Maldives delegation here at the climate summit. He's joining us now. Welcome back to Democracy Now! It's great to have you with us.
Thank you very much, and thank you for having me.
So here we are sitting in a convention center that's shaped as a coal mine on an old coal mine site. And behind us, hundreds of climate activists on what was supposed to be this last day of the talks, though I think they're expected to go until tomorrow. Talk about what has been achieved so far and why you're so deeply concerned that these talks are failing.
Well, for small island nations and a number of low-lying countries, climate change is not something in the future. It is happening, and it's happening in the Maldives. We have coastal erosion. We have issues with our water. We have food security issues. We have a number of climate impacts that are being felt right now. For us, it's not in the future. We have to have an understanding in this conference of the parties. This is the 24th conference of the parties. And the most importantly, from this conference, we expect delegates to give us a rule book on how to implement the Paris Agreement on climate change. We also hope that countries would accept the IPCC report on the scientific report on climate change.
Now, of course, the IPCC is the Nobel Peace Prize winning scientific panel of the UN.
Yes, and they have been suggesting that anything above 1.5 degrees would be very detrimental to a number of people, especially to countries like the Maldives. We would lose our reefs. We would lose our clean water. We would have a dwindling fish catch. We would lose our livelihood, and it would be very difficult for us to survive in the Maldives. So this summit is very important, mostly because it would give us a strategic action plan on how to implement the Paris Agreement.
Now, there's a lot of UN lingo that is hard to understand, but extremely important in what the world agrees. Can you explain what common but differentiated responsibility is all about and why you're concerned about the U.S. role here?
Well, it means that we have a common responsibility, but it should be viewed differentially. Developing countries, countries such as the Maldives, we did not contribute to climate change. But we are the first to suffer from it. So we have to differentiate our responsibility and a big emitting country such as the United States.
What are your other concerns? And explain whether or not you think it makes a difference that President Trump is a climate change denier. I mean, the climate negotiators that you're dealing with here, your head of the Maldives climate negotiation, are actually pretty much the same as under Obama, isn't that right? They're civil servants.
Well, they're exactly the same people, and therefore we are able to have good conversations. But of course, they have different briefs. Civil servants can be the same, but when their political masters change, their briefs change, and therefore the manner in which they engage change. We want to see the United States agreeing to incorporate the scientific reports that is suggesting that climate, the world temperature should not rise above 1.5 degrees.
2.7 degrees Fahrenheit.
2.7 degrees Fahrenheit. So that is what we are requesting and asking from the United States, is that to agree
to the scientific findings that the world temperatures should not go beyond this critical limit.
And yet, isn't there a push to say not only won't they hit 2 degrees Celsius, but 3 degrees, when the IPCC report said we are facing climate catastrophe if we don't change our practices within 12 years?
Well, if we have business as usual, we are going to... the Maldives is just not going to be there if we have business as usual. And not just the Maldives, a large number of low-lying areas in the world, a quarter of the world's population live on these low-lying areas. And with the Maldives, Manhattan will also sink. So it's just not the Maldives that we are talking about. In our case, we do not have dry land to go to. In Manhattan, they can probably go to dry land.
So from the Maldives to Manhattan, do you think these climate talks are failing? The UN Secretary General, Guterres, said it's suicidal if they do.
Well, I've just come out from a conversation with the Secretary General. The Secretary General has assured us, small island nations, that he will do whatever he can to see that the IPCC report, the scientific report, will be incorporated into the final outcome of this conference. So again, I have a little bit of hope that the Secretary General will be able to do that. I understand that the Secretary General will be in conversation with the President of the United States and also other countries who are not agreeing to include the scientific findings of the UN.
In October 2009, our guest, Maldives President Mohamed Nasheed, held a cabinet meeting underwater in an attempt to bring attention to the dire consequences of climate change. Nasheed and 11 of his government ministers wore scuba gear and plunged nearly 20 feet into the Indian Ocean.
We are actually trying to send our message, let the world know what is happening and what will happen to the Maldives if climate change is not checked. This is a challenging situation, and we want to see that everyone else is also occupied as much as we are, and would like to see that people actually do something about it.
Mohamed Nasheed, former president of the Maldives and climate champion. Yes, you were president at the time that you held this underwater cabinet meeting.
Well, we had to impress upon the international community the gravity of the issue. If we proceed business as usual, the Maldives is just simply not going to survive. We do not want to die, and we refuse to give up hope. We have to see that we survive, and to do that, we have been working with every single person possible so that we will survive. Now, in many senses, what we see from the United States is encouraging. California, being the fifth largest economy in the world, is going to become carbon neutral. The United States emission has come down. The federal government, of course, has different views, but the people of the United States, I believe, do understand the gravity of the issue, and therefore they want to embrace the future. Now, renewable energy is now financially more feasible, economically more viable than the old technology. So we think that these new technologies will be embraced by the people of the United States.
We're hearing a lot of discussion, especially from the developing world, about extreme transparency and the problems people have with that. You know, the world hears transparency, you think, good. What's wrong with it?
Well, we do not know how much. Different countries commit different amounts of assistance and different levels of assistance to countries in stress, to vulnerable countries. What small islands and the least developed countries are asking is transparency and clarity on what we will be receiving, how you would be tackling these issues. That is why this so-called rule book becomes important.
And explain the rule book very briefly. Again, a lot of jargon, and yet it means so much.
Well, it means to implement the Paris Agreement, you have to have a strategic action plan. You have to have modalities on how we would be able to come out with the outcomes of the Paris Agreement. So to do that, we have to have rules to say country X would be doing that, country Y would be doing that, person Z would be doing this. So it's a whole lot of bylaws that would allow us to implement the Paris Agreement.
Is the United States trying to water down the Paris Agreement and then regardless leave, as Trump promised he would pull the U.S. out? It'll just take a few more years.
Well, I think listening to U.S. negotiators, what they're trying to do is to leave a window open for them to be able to come back. And I am sure that the United States, the good people of the United States, would want to come back into the international fora, and they would want the planet intact. And I'm quite confident that the United States will be in the Paris Agreement.
So as we're talking, people are chanting, they're singing, they're giving speeches right behind us. Among the things they are saying is, you know, they're chanting people power. Can you talk about the significance? I mean, you're a government official now once again, though you've been detained, what, something like 14 times. What civil society action like this means?
It means a lot. Politicians only do what their people want done. Politicians cannot do anything other than what they've pledged to their people. So political minds change when there is action and when the people talk. I believe that this is very important, and I think people all over the world should rise up and ask their politicians to act.
Well, in fact, that's exactly what they're singing behind us. We will rise up. Would you say these talks are failing?
Well, when I left very late last night from the conference, it was looking like that it might go into difficulties. But now, after having discussions with the Secretary General, I am very hopeful that there will be an understanding.
Well, I thank you so much for being with us as people are chanting and cheering behind us here at the UN Climate Summit in Katowice, Poland. We've been speaking with the former president of the Maldives, Mohamed Nasheed, detained 14 times. He's been tortured and held in the Maldives. Now he is the UN climate negotiator for the Maldives here in Poland. When we come back, you'll learn what Extinction Rebellion is, but first we'll speak with one of the protesters who is just involved with what's happening behind us. This is Democracy Now! Back in a minute. And some lavender spring turned autumn. Things have a way of changing. Lifetime of seasons. Was it years or weeks or days? It wasn't just a dream we shared, but seasons that change yesterday. You let me know love is the same. All back. Winter Green and Summer Blue by Nancy Wilson, the legendary jazz singer and song stylist who died Thursday at her home in California. She was 81 years old. And blue and green are the theme of this year's UN Climate Summit. Yes, we are broadcasting from the UN Climate Talks in Katowice, Poland, where hundreds of demonstrators are gathered just behind our set, demanding bolder action from world leaders on climate change. The actions organized by the Global Campaign to Demand Climate Justice. Protesters have filled the staircase inside the convention center. They're holding banners saying, which side are you on? People, not polluters. System change, not climate change. This is Rita Okwakwa of Friends of the Earth Nigeria.
We are here to denounce for solutions by big polluters who are acting as saints at this COP. We are here to promote solutions that are sustainable, that are people-powered. We are here to expose the iniquities of corporations at COP that are causing devastating environmental and social consequences in communities around the world. In the Niger Delta, where I live and come from, I know that there are a lot of oil pollution that is devastating community lives and livelihoods. Water polluted, our soils are polluted, our farmlands are polluted. Women are suffering. Communities at the front line are being victimized by these corporations who have rife human rights abuses, who is causing a lot of scarcity of food in our communities, who is destroying our local food system, destroying our forests, and causing a lot of climate change in communities, affecting people and our climate. We say no. We are here to denounce the activities. We are here to promote solutions that are sustainable. We're here to kick them out and let the people in.
That was Rita Awaka of Friends of the Earth Nigeria. And as we broadcast today from the UN climate talks, right next to us, hundreds of people are walking out with their hands up in a fist sign. We are now joined by one of the demonstrators. Maya Menenzis is a Canadian climate activist, member of the Canadian Youth Delegation here at the UN Climate Talks, senior manager of development at climate justice organization The Leap, a migrant rights organizer with No One Is Illegal. It's great to have you with us. Describe for us what you're seeing right now, right behind you, Maya.
Well, we've gotten a really incredible coalition of climate activists from across the global south, but also their allies in the global north, who are calling for the decorporatization of the COP and for a climate justice movement that centers people, not polluters.
And what does that mean? And are you concerned about what's come out of these talks, though they're continuing until tomorrow? What are you demanding has to happen?
I think we're demanding that we want to see people's rights and protection for marginalized peoples at the core of how we have these climate discussions, which we know just never happens. It's not in the interests of wealthy corporate elites to make sure that marginalized people's voices are heard. And that's why community organizers have to mobilize in the way that we do to ensure that that message reaches the public. Mm-hmm. And that's what we were calling for today.
Mm-hmm. According to some projections, one-fifth of the world's population in 2100, that's 2 billion people, could become climate refugees. That's by the end of the century. Have UN climate talks here addressed the staggering number that we're talking about? You are particularly focused on migrants. And what does climate migrants mean?
These talks never have that discussion at the core of them. In fact, a lot of the ways that we talk about migrant and refugee issues actually uses language that makes it very easy for right-wing extremism to navigate the space in a way where we start to call people and we refer to them as illegals. A lot of the conversations around migrants and refugees center things like regular migration, safe migration. And it allows a lot of space for that language suddenly to be used to call people illegal, irregular crossings. And that's what I organized against in Toronto. Right now, we're seeing, of course, a lot of people on the move with the migrant caravan, waiting. Many people who have applied for asylum in the United States, many people whose claims will be denied. A lot of the organizing that we do when we leave the COP spaces and when we go home is fight for things like the Safe Third Country Agreement to be rescinded in Canada. The Safe Third Country Agreement is basically a piece of law that bars people who have applied for asylum in the U.S. and been denied access to apply for asylum in Canada. Migrant rights activists have been calling in Canada for this to be rescinded for a very long time. It basically says that the U.S. is a safe country. We know that the U.S. has rampant xenophobia and that this will actually serve to bar people who are in the migrant caravan from being able to get access to Canada. And that's something we want to see removed immediately.
We just reported in our headlines about the 7-year-old Guatemalan girl who came over the border with her dad. She has just died of dehydration and shock. We just learned this while in the custody of U.S. Border Patrol. They didn't take her to the hospital until her temperature peaked over 105 degrees. This treatment of migrants and what this bodes for the future and where you think the kind of activism you're involved in can play a role.
I think we actually need to invest in organizers who are fighting this idea that migrants and refugees are seen as dangerous in our society. It's a very, very frightening common theme that we're seeing across the cuff and that we're seeing at home. This language that has allowed people, I guess actually a story is when we found out about the caging of migrant children and the removal from their families in the U.S., there was, of course, international days of action where people occupied outside of U.S. consulates calling for this end. When I was going through the crowd afterwards, I spoke at that rally, and when I was going through the crowd later talking to parents who were there with their children, who were saying, you know, I said, why are you here? What draws you here? We know these children are being traumatized, they're being treated so inhumanely, and we need an end to detentions and we need an end to deportations. And many family members who were there said, well, I don't actually believe that people shouldn't be imprisoned. I just think families should be in jail together. And that's a very scary thing. It's a very scary thing to be faced with. So what we're trying to organize on the ground against is actually a rejection that some people are deserving of basic dignity and rights and some are not. In the global climate crisis, we understand that most of the world either will be turned into a desert or will be uninhabitable due to the temperatures, storm changes. We need to make sure that a climate plan that talks about decreasing emissions also has an open conversation that the borders must be open and people must have clear avenues to status and citizenship and safety in wherever they want to move to.
Can you quickly talk about the Canadian role right here at the UN talks? One of your representatives, her event was just disrupted.
Yes, definitely. Well, Canada has an interesting role. We're touted as a very progressive government, and at the same time, we push some of the harshest refugee and migrant laws out there. Right now, we're talking about, there was an event, of course, that we heard about between, I think it was Claire Perry and Catherine McKenna was on that panel
and
as well.
And explain who they are.
Claire Perry, I believe, is the UK Environment Minister. Catherine McKenna is the Canadian Minister of Environment and Climate Change. And it was a conversation about getting off coal, which is all fine and great. But the Canadian government right now, 80% of oil and gas emissions, largely coming out of the tar sands, are going to be exempt from the federal carbon pricing plan, which is outrageous. That's a complete oxymoron to say that we care about the climate and reducing emissions, but then exempting 80% of oil and gas from that carbon pricing plan. And so the role of Canada is interesting in that regard, but we're here to basically call out domestic policies that are completely out of sync with what Canada says on the international stage, from migration and refugee issues to carbon emissions plans that don't hold polluters accountable at all.
The United Nations formally recognized climate migration for the first time this week, with more than 160 nations agreeing to the United Nations Global Compact for Safe, Orderly, and Regular Migration at a meeting in Marrakesh, Morocco. The compact asked nations to, quote, provide basic services for migrants, whether they enter a country legally or illegally, and facilitate access to procedures for family reunification for migrants at all skill levels, and establish mechanisms for the portability of social security entitlements, unquote. The United States did not sign on to the agreement. In a statement, the U.S. State Department said the United States proclaims and reaffirms its belief that decisions about how to secure its borders and whom to admit for legal residency or to grant citizenship are among the most important sovereign decisions the state can make and are not subject to negotiation. Maya, your thoughts?
I think something that really bothers me about all of this language is when countries, and of course the context for me being Canada, when countries like us sign on to these agreements, I think that's fantastic in a lot of different ways. But also, we have domestic policies that completely fly in the face of it. In Canada, for example, with the Safe Third Country Agreement, we know that people who are applying for asylum in the migrant caravan, many of whom have come from Central and South America, are on the move not because of tsunamis, but because of war and destabilization. We know that Canada supported the coup in Honduras in 2009 in order to continue Canadian mining practices and to expand their reach. We know that the many Hondurans that are in the migrant caravan who have applied for asylum in the United States are not going to be able to apply for asylum in Canada because of the Safe Third Country Agreement. This is war and mining profiteering that Canada is championing in Central and South America. And then, of course, when these people are on the move because of political destabilization, we deny them at the border. And this is a climate issue. And it's not taken up in these documents the way that it should be. And it's not taken up by the Canadian government the way they need to be accountable for it.
Hmm. Well, I want to thank you so much for being with us, Maya Meneses, Canadian climate activist, member of the Canadian Youth Delegation here at the UN Climate Talk, senior manager of development at climate justice organization The Leap, also a migrant rights organizer with No One Is Illegal. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. As we broadcast from the UN Climate Talks in Poland, we turn now to look at a UK-based movement taking extreme action to fight the climate crisis. It's called Extinction Rebellion. Its members have been super gluing themselves to government buildings, shutting down roads, taking to the streets to sound the alarm about the impending catastrophe of global warming. Extinction Rebellion marched here in Katowice last Saturday to protest UN climate talks. In November, Extinction Rebellion protesters shut down London bridges, blockaded the UK Department for Business and Energy, and attempted to interrupt Brexit negotiations.
They're very concerned about the state the Earth is in, the seriousness of things. You know, we're leading towards 3 degrees centigrade. Well, that's way outside the range that human development has known. Enormous unknown dangers.
Tell the truth. Everybody needs to know what's coming. We need to know what's coming. Everybody needs to know. You need to wake up.
I only got arrested for the first time 2 days ago, and now I'm doing it again. So basically, you become disobedient towards the system as a result of our impending danger.
The government is criminally complacent in the mass murder of all life on this planet, and I will not be silent.
Those are members of Extinction Rebellion, a movement taking radical action to combat the climate crisis. It started in the United Kingdom just 6 months ago, is now spread to at least 35 countries. Extinction Rebellion's demanding governments commit to legally binding measures to slash consumption, reduce carbon emissions to net zero by 2025. We're joined right now by Extinction Rebellion activist Liam Gary Balch. He just participated in the action here at the UN Climate Summit, not far from the Democracy Now! Set. It's great to have you with us, Liam. Even using words like global warming or climate change, people feel does not convey the urgency of this issue. You all have decided to use the term extinction. Extinction Rebellion is your group. Talk about what you're doing.
So we've been talking to people about the real science that we're seeing now, not in an alarmist way, but in a realistic way. We are now facing what could be the next mass extinction. We're already grieving over the lives lost, both human and otherwise, to climate change. And we're seeing and talking to people about the fact that we might now be facing human extinction. And so we're asking people to face that grief and feel that emotional response to this crisis, what we're calling an emergency crisis. We want to shift the language to that emergency crisis and to respond to that and move through that into action.
So explain your actions. It's just been 6 months since you guys got started. What have you done in the UK?
So We just actually did our first action just a month and a half ago. We gathered outside of the UK Parliament and we declared a rebellion against the government. This is not a one-off protest or direct action against a specific corporation. This is an ongoing rebellion against our government in the UK over their inaction on climate change. So we lay down in the road and other people read out the Declaration of Rebellion, and then we said, we're here, we're going to keep rebelling, and I was arrested that day and taken away.
You were arrested?
Yeah.
And what happened?
And, so, and then we were released. Most of our activists have been released so far. They're aware that part of our movement is the fact that we have hundreds, if not thousands now, people willing to get arrested for this cause, willing to give up their freedom about this issue, because the time for action is now. And we're calling on our government to tell the truth.
Super gluing yourselves? Explain what you did.
Yeah, so we shut down the Department for Business, Energy and Industrial Strategy a week later. And that led to a whole series of actions where people were risking arrest. We saw that activists decided to shut down this department for 6 hours by super gluing themselves to the doors. And that's the department that's having backroom meetings with fracking companies while refusing to go and meet the people who have to live next door to where they're trying to frack in the UK.
You shut down 5 bridges. How?
So we've just seen an amazing response. From that month and a half ago original action, our campaign has just exploded. We now have a reach of 100,000 people. We're in over 35 countries around the world. And 6,000 people came out on the street on the 17th of November and blocked 5 bridges in central London. We had trained affinity groups in non-violent civil disobedience to take those bridges initially, and then members of the public in their thousands took to the streets and sat in the roads and celebrated our resistance against this system. People are angry and they're calling for a change to the system. I think that's what we've been seeing in the action going on behind us here. That's what we're seeing in movements like the Sunrise Movement and the school strikes. This is being reflected all across the world right now.
In fact, today is the school strike globally that Greta Thunberg has called for. And we're going to hear from Polish high school students who made it to the COP today, who walked out of school. How would you assess, this is your fourth COP, Conference of Parties, your fourth UN Climate Summit. Do you think it has succeeded? Do you think it's failing?
I am aware that this system is broken. The political system in the UK is broken. The political system here at the COP is broken. We're asking for a citizens' assembly to be formed, a whole new system which can solve this crisis without the politicians kind of continuing to talk to each other. I'm here at COP to talk to activists on the ground, to learn from each other across grassroots movements around the world. And we're here to talk with those people about how they can join us next year on the 15th of April when we declare an international rebellion.
I want to thank you very much, Liam Geary-Balch, activist with the new organization based in Britain but spreading around the globe, Extinction Rebellion. You're planning a week-long rebellion, April 15th?
Yeah, and we hope to see you there and we hope to see your viewers there. Please find your local groups, get involved, get trained in nonviolent civil disobedience, and take part in the Extinction Rebellion.
We urge you to continue to watch Democracy Now! As we are there not only in the streets, but in the suites and at these UN climate summits, as well as the gatherings that are taking place all over the world. Stay with us.
What have we done to the world? Look what we've done. What about all the peace that you pledge your only son? What about flowering fields? Is there a time? What about all the dreams that you said was yours and mine? Did you ever stop to notice all the children dead from war? Did you ever stop to notice this crying of these weeping shores? Aha! I
The music break is Polish high school students singing Michael Jackson's Earth Song here at the COP24. The UN climate talks we're broadcasting from here in Katowice, Poland. I'm Amy Goodman. 15-year-old Swedish climate activist Greta Thunberg has called for a global climate strike today to protest inaction at the UN climate summit. Greta made international headlines after she refused to go to school in August and September and began a school strike for climate. Greta made the call for today's strike in a video posted on Twitter.
Hello, my name is Greta Thunberg. I am 15 years old and I come from Sweden. And I am here at the United Nations climate change talks in Poland. We are in week two of negotiations here, and as of now, there are no signs of commitments to climate action. Our emissions are still increasing, at the same time as the science has clearly told us that we need to act now to keep the planet within 1.5 degrees of warming. Whoever you are, wherever you are, we need you now. This Friday, the 14th of December, I am calling for an international climate strike. Please strike with us. Stand outside your parliament or local government office, even for just a short while, to let them know that we demand climate action.
The words of 15-year-old Swedish climate activist Greta Thunberg, who just left the UN climate summit last night, her dad driving their electric car through the night so she could sit in front of the Swedish parliament once again, where she goes every Friday in a school strike against climate change. Here in Katowice, Poland, at least 30 local high school students answered Greta's call, walking out of classes today and carrying their message here to the COP. The group sang and chanted while sitting on the steps of the main conference hall, holding signs that said 12 years left and hashtag climate strike. This is student Gosia Czachowska speaking with Democracy Now!'s Carla Wills.
My name is Gosia, and I live next to Katowice, and I go to school in Katowice. And I wasn't there today because I want to climate protest, and I want to support Greta with her idea, and I want to politicians to make a good choice for all of us.
And so you said you were inspired by Greta Thunberg, who spoke here at COP. Can you talk about her message and why it resonated with you?
Well, I think that what she did was really brave and amazing, because not many young people have the feeling that they can do something. And I think that one person can do a lot, and she's a great example of this.
You are holding up some letters while you are just rehearsing. Talk about what the words are that you are holding up.
We have letters that say 12 years left, and it's because of the Paris Agreement and about scientists that counted that in if we don't do nothing till 2030, we are really in danger. And, well, it may end really badly for all of us, for humanity and for entire world.
And tell me what song you're singing today.
We are singing song Earth Song by Michael Jackson. And we are singing it a cappella. And this song is really beautiful, and it's perfect for today's occasion.
What about sunrise? What about a rain? What about all the things that you said we were to gain? What about killing fields? Is there a time? About all the things that you said were yours and mine. Did you ever stop to notice all the blood we've shed before? Did you ever stop to notice this crying earth, this weeping shore?
What is your message to the negotiators here at COP?
They know the facts. And maybe they sometimes don't want to admit it, but they know everything what they need to know. They know the solutions. They know that we need to change, because otherwise the world will change in a way we don't want to know. So my message is to not ignore anymore all the threats and to do something. And not just for money, not just for economics, but for us, for all the people, for all the animals and plants, and for our world.
Special thanks to John Hamilton, Carla Wills, and Hani Massoud. And an update on 15-year-old climate activist Greta Thunberg. She returned to Sweden last night. They were driving an electric car. She was with her father. Said she tried to get to Malmo. She wouldn't make it to Stockholm. She just posted a photo on Twitter of herself participating in the climate strike. This is Democracy Now! We end today's coverage of the UN climate talks here in Katowice, Poland, with Salim Olhak, climate scientist, director of the International Center for Climate Change and Development in Bangladesh, advising the bloc of least developed countries in the climate negotiations. What is your progress report as we come to the end of these climate talks? Are they succeeding? Are they failing?
Well, they're succeeding at a very low level of getting all the technical stuff done, but it's not succeeding at all at the political level in terms of the emergency that we have of climate change with 12 years remaining. The COP decisions that we see on paper at the moment are nowhere near enough to be ambitious to tackle the problem at the scale that it needs to be.
And what does it mean that, perhaps, well, the historically greatest greenhouse gas emitter, the United States, the president has not come, and the president, in fact, is a climate denier. What does that mean? How does it affect this summit?
I think the effect of President Trump and his delegation here, I'm not going to count the United States there, it's just him and his coterie of people, have joined forces with Saudi Arabia and with Russia to, in fact, try and undo the Paris Agreement that we had agreed a few years ago. And they've chosen a very trivial thing to talk about, which is whether we note or welcome the IPCC special report on 1.5. But it is a significant thing because they're trying to undo the science and challenge the science and not believe in the science, and that's not acceptable. 193 countries want to welcome the report, and only the four countries are saying that they don't want to welcome
it. And they succeeded. They got the language change from welcoming that report to noting the report. What does that mean? Is it just semantics?
It is semantics, in a sense, but it's much more than semantics. It means that they are trying to undo what we have collectively done in Paris, at the Paris Agreement, and we will not accept that, speaking now on behalf of the most vulnerable countries. It is something we cannot take on board.
And yet the U.S. is pulling out of the accord. So why do people listen to them?
Well, that's the conundrum. I mean, if Mr. Trump wants to withdraw, why did he send a delegation here at all? We don't understand that. I think the logic is the delegation isn't here to withdraw the U.S. The delegation is to try and scupper the rest of the countries going ahead. And that's what they've done together with Saudi Arabia, Russia and Kuwait.
So what are you seeing as the critical issues in this last minute?
Well, from the vulnerable countries' perspective and also the vulnerable communities with whom I do a lot of work, the most important thing is to recognize the fact that we now have loss and damage because of climate change. This is an issue that we've talked about for some time, but it's a reality in 2018, including the wildfires in California and the hurricanes on the East Coast in the United States. Those caused a significant amount of loss and damage that is now attributable to the fact that we have increased the temperature of the globe already by a degree. And another 1.5 or even a 2-degree rise is going to be catastrophic for the rest of the world. So we need loss and damage to be recognized and particularly to be compensated for.
Finally, will you be joining Extinction Rebellion?
I am a member of Extinction Rebellion. Here's my card.
Wearing that pin.
Yes.
Salim Olhak, thank you very much for being with us. Climate scientist, director of the International Center for Climate Change and Development in Bangladesh. And that wraps up our 10th COP that Democracy Now! Has covered, beginning in Copenhagen in 2009. Special thanks to our crew here in Katowice, Poland, Chanel Lai, Andrew Craig, Philip Hardy, Sean Russell, Kirsty Lee, Jennifer Brewer, Zoman Jankovic, David Pento. A very happy birthday to Renee Feltz. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Nermeen Sheikh, Carla Wills, Tammy Warrenoff, Sam Alkoff, John Hamilton, Ravi Karan, Hani Massoud, Charina Nudura, and Libby Rainey. Mike DeFilippo and Miguel Nogueira are engineers. Special thanks to Dennis Moynihan as well, to Julie Crosby, to Hugh Grand, David Prude, Ariel Boone, Vesta Godars, and Carl Marxer. This is Democracy Now! To see our full week's coverage from Katowice, Poland, you can go to democracynow.org. And if you want to see Democracy Now! Attempting to question the U.S. representatives at these climate talks, go to democracynow.org. You can read the transcripts as well as the audio, video transcripts and podcasts. And to see Greta Thunberg give her plenary address, the 15-year-old climate activist, go to democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.